Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I am Johnny Roll, and we've got a million things to talk about. Just brief little preview, things you can expect. We're going to be breaking down in just a minute the Bernie Sanders town hall on CNN last night. A little bit later on in the show, Donald Trump and his top economic advisors disagree on a few fairly basic things. We're going to evaluate who is actually right on these issues. We've also got a new inclusion in the much vaunted roles of garbage people. We're going to be throwing an entire media organization in there today, and maybe a host on cable news as well, if there's time. Along the way, we've got two awesome guests. Pete Harrison is going to be joining us to talk about the housing policies of a couple different presidential contenders in this Democratic primary. And then Anand Giridharadas is going to be back on the show to talk taxation, wealth inequality, a number of different related issues. Should be a lot of fun. It generally is when he's on the show. But we've got so much to do, let's just jump right into it. Last night, CNN had a town hall with Bernie Sanders, his first big media event after declaring that he's going to be a contender in the Democratic primary this time around. I was a bit surprised because I thought they were only going to be giving it to the most sort of milquetoast centrist candidates like Howard Schultz. But no, they had Bernie. And so the question then became, are they having him on so that they can kneecap him? And look, there were a lot of tough questions. I do believe that they represented real concerns that people have about Bernie Sanders and his candidacy. And I think that also CNN was looking for those and made sure that those questions made it on out of all of the questions you can ask. But that's fine. There should be easy questions. There should be tough questions. And there's a couple different elements that I want to focus on in this analysis of last night's town hall. The first is Bernie Sanders' ability to quickly establish and reinforce throughout, regardless of what the question is, his policy platform. And you saw that in a very strong way. So let's turn to this first video. The much expected questions, how do you pay for any of this stuff? Here's his response.
At a time when the people on top have so much, while the middle class shrinks and we have so many people living in poverty, if your question is, am I going to demand that the wealthy and large corporations start paying their fair share of taxes, damn right, I will. All right? And let me give you, people say, where are you going to get the money? Where are you going to get the money? Amazon, owned by the wealthiest guy in the world, made $5 billion last year in profits. Anyone here know how much they paid in taxes? That's right. That's where we're going to begin getting the money.
Now, I do have to disagree with Bernie a little bit. I believe that I read an article showing that they actually made far more than that in profits, but he was right about the important part, and that is that they're paying no taxes. Now, I've also seen a couple of different defenses over the past few days, editorials in business journals and things like that, about Amazon, saying that people are wrong to get on Amazon for not paying any taxes. It's not that they didn't pay any taxes because they're a villain. It's just because they're savvy with their strategy. And it turns out that actually they gave a lot of extra stock options to employees, and those employees will pay taxes, which because we now we pay taxes at a higher rate than corporations do, means that the government actually ends up making more money overall. And I'm sure that is very convincing inside the building at the Wall Street Journal. But for me, looking as an outsider, I think I don't care what tricky pazicky stuff you do with stock options. If you are the biggest corporation in the history of corporations, you should pay something. You should pay as much as I pay each year for Amazon Prime. You should pay as much as I pay to rent Casino Royale. You should pay something. I don't care how smart you are. I'm sure you're way smarter than me, but I pay my taxes and I expect you to do at least as much as I do. To the larger point that what he's saying there, notice the applause that he gets on certain lines. So when he says that he's damn right he's going to make sure that they pay their fair share in taxes, it's not just the message, but it's how it's delivered. So there are more candidates than there were in past cycles who want you to believe that they can identify the people who have been screwing us over, the corporations that have been screwing us over, and they're going to be the sheriff that reins them in. Lots of people want that mantle. They want that identity. But not everybody has earned it, and not everybody can communicate in a way that makes it clear that that's actually who they are. But Bernie Sanders does not have that problem. Whatever other problems you think his campaign might have, he is authentic when it comes to that. And we know that in the past, over the past year or so, he has taken on Jeff Bezos. So he's taken on Washington Post, he's taken on Amazon, he's taken on Walt Disney. Like, he is going Walmart, his Stop Walmart and Stop Bezos acts. He is willing to actually identify the people who have put us in the position we're in and gotten results. So maybe in 2016, there were people who were trying to tell you, oh, but what has Bernie actually done? In the past couple of years, Bernie has done far more, even outside of the literal halls of government, than virtually any other candidate running in the cycle. So when it comes to Amazon, when it comes to Walmart, he has already notched wins in the past year with Disney, the workers. He has notched a win there. So this is very much like, this is his preferred terrain to fight this primary on. And I think that the way that the country is moving, I think that this is where we're going to end up. And so I do think that that gives him a major advantage. And that was on display in this town hall. Now, another big topic that came up in the Bernie Sanders town hall was Donald Trump and his supporters. How do you beat him? How do you win them over? And so first, how is he going to deal with Donald Trump on the debate stage?
If you're the Democratic presidential nominee and you're on the debate stage with President Trump, how will you engage with him?
Well, we'll bring a lie detector along. And every time he lies, it goes beep. That would be the first thing. But I think the fraud that Trump is, the pathological liar that he is, has to be exposed. So we are going to hold him accountable for what he said and for what he did. He said he was going to provide health care to everybody. And then he proposes to throw 32 million people off the health care that they have. He said, you all remember, he said, I'm a different type of Republican. I'm not going to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And he brings forward a budget that does just that.
So obviously the line about the lie detector was great, although he later said, I am worried about artificial intelligence in the lie detector. Who's it actually working for? But no, that's good. Look, my position now on calling out Trump's lies has become a little bit more nuanced because I have been beaten down for years by how little people care about whether things are true or whether they're false. So look, I think we should continue to fact check him. We should continue to call out when he lies, and we should do so even though it is unlikely to matter to a significant chunk of the population. They just don't care. They've been lied to literally thousands of times by Donald Trump, and they love him all the more with every lie. But we should still call it out. And importantly, it's not just when he gets a fact wrong. It's when he lies to his own base, to his own voters, about extremely the most consequential policies. So if they end up losing their health care when he promises that they'll actually get increased access to health care, then that needs to be pointed out and driven home in a campaign. When he says that his trade policies are going to protect them and help to build the industries that they work in, and then it turns out that they've actually, those companies are starting to go under and, you know, all of that, that needs to be pointed out. So those are the consequential sorts of fact checking that we need to continue to do, whether we're out there engaging in politics, we're in the media, or we're on the debate stage. But it's not just Donald Trump, it is also his supporters. So how do you win those over?
How do you plan to unite such a polarized country if your policies are moving further away from where most Americans stand?
Okay, I look at it a little bit differently. That the country is polarized, I agree. And that has a lot to do with Trump's fostering a division and hatred, to be honest with you. Here's the other side of that story. Is that if you ask people in red states, conservative states, you say, do you think it makes sense to give huge tax breaks to billionaires and then cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which is what the Republican leadership wants? You know what they say in red states? You're crazy. Of course we don't believe in that. Do you believe that healthcare is a right? Yeah, we do. Think we should raise the minimum wage? Yeah. So I start off from the premise that we're not quite as divided as some would think. The reality is that what goes on here in Washington is that many of the folks who come here really are not reflective, in my view, of the people they represent. They're much more reflective of the billionaires who fund their campaigns and the lobbyists.
That is 100% true, and of course, very classic Bernie. And I think that when you take as a whole what he's going to be running on, as well as his willingness to engage with Donald Trump in a more aggressive and open and, I would say, illuminating fashion than any of the candidates that we have in the primary right now, I think that's going to be a powerful combination. That he already, in his economic reforms, appeals to many of those people. Obviously not all, but many of those people. And he's going to be backing it up by pointing out how they have not only been lied to historically, they already They already knew that. They already felt that in 2016. That's one of the reasons they were looking for some alternative, but that they've been continued to be lied to and victimized by Donald Trump ever since. Now, there's additional nuance to it. I think that a more significant chunk of that base is driven by xenophobia, Islamophobia, racism, misogyny, homophobia than Bernie Sanders does. But I understand that he wants to be diplomatic. He wants to bring those people over, and he will try to do so if possible. We're talking about sort of the entry level steps of what's going to be a very long and complex process, regardless of who the nominee ends up being. But I think that Bernie Sanders has a strong case to make that he is very well positioned to try to bring over more of those people. And in a country where elections are turned on just a couple of percentage points, the ability to do that, even to a minor degree where other candidates can't, could be extremely consequential in making sure that Donald Trump does not win re-election in 2020. Now, that said, there's much more I wish we could talk about. We don't have a lot of time, though. We're going to take a break. We come back. Pete Harrison of Data for Progress is going to be joining us to break down the housing policies of a number of different 2020 candidates after that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
If you have engaged even briefly in the fantasy of someday owning your own home and then looked at how expensive it is these days, as well as a number of other issues around there, you know that our country's got a gigantic problem when it comes to housing. And so how are the Democratic contenders in this primary going to deal with these problems? We are joined now by Pete Harrison, senior housing advisor for Data for Progress, to break down some of their plans. Pete, welcome to the show.
Hey, John, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Very glad to have you here. So we are going to delve into three different candidates' housing legislation. But before we get into that, overall, why do we think that housing policy is going to be important in this primary? Are people actually, are they paying attention to this time around?
Yeah, I mean, look, if you want to talk about an actual national emergency, the affordable housing crisis is that. We have virtually every county in the country does not have enough affordable housing. Half of all renters are paying too much rent per month, and homeownership rates have not recovered since the Great Recession. So this is an issue that affects renters and owners in big cities and small towns across the country. And it's, frankly, we think there's a lot of political opportunity for a 2020 contender in a crowded field to have a sweeping vision for housing. And there's also the moral urgency to do so.
And I can only speak for the LA situation, but it is dire. I will say that, as well as you point out a number of other parts. So you talked a little bit about this, about some of the issues. But in terms of looking at a comparison of these different plans, does there seem to be generally a high level of agreement about exactly what the issue is that needs to be fixed?
Yeah, I mean, great question. Short answer is no. I mean, housing is a big, wonky, not very sexy policy discussion. So I think, which is exciting, particularly early in the primary, because there are a number of ways to go about this. So I think so far the three bills that we have reviewed are coming at it from broadly different angles. I think for us at Data for Progress, there are four categories that ultimately we want to see every plan have. The first one is direct rental assistance and that's supporting rent control measures that about half a dozen states are doing so far. Second is ending exclusionary and restrictive zoning and apartment bans, which restricts the amount of construction, particularly in wealthier communities. Three is to build more housing, whether it's subsidizing private housing for low income or ideally building more public housing. And four, ending the speculative nature of housing. I mean, Wall Street is coming in and owning single family homes and apartment buildings at a large scale. So we have to tackle that. And that really means tackling the tax code, excuse me.
So let's start with Elizabeth Warren. What are some of the highlights of her policy?
Yeah, by far of the three that we have talked through so far, she deserves a lot of credit. I think her primary focus is putting actual money into building affordable housing. She is also tackling a lot of the racist legacy of housing policy in this country by trying to get communities that have prevented housing from being constructed, from addressing communities that have been gentrified. So I think she gets a lot of credit there for having a much more holistic approach. She's not just coming at it from the rental side or the homeownership side.
And based on some of the research that's available on Data for Progress that I read in your write-up about this, for Kamala Harris, her Rent Relief Act, it seems to be sort of on the opposite end. It's specifically targeted at one of those issues that you were discussing.
Yeah, she is exclusively focusing on direct rental assistance. The Warren bill does not have anything about that. So, you know, to credit where you're seeing a lot of pressure for renters, particularly in some of the more crowded cities like LA or New York in my case. So she is trying to figure out a way to, through the tax code, give back some of that money if you're spending more than 30% of your income on rent. You know, the problem with that is that's not exactly how most renters budget their money. Having one tax credit come after the year is not necessarily the best way to do that. But it does speak to the issue that renters are paying too much money and it's going to landlords. Many of them are Wall Street speculators.
Yeah, and it seems like, I mean, look, certainly there are a lot of renters paying a higher percentage of their income than in the past. So that obviously hurts the economy in a number of different other ways because so much of the money is going to this one unified area of it. But when you're talking about like the Wall Street and, you know, these big buyers coming in and buying up all available houses basically and doling them out very slowly, making it very difficult for people to transition out of renting an apartment into owning a home, that seems like something that's certainly worthy of attention as well.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. It's really pernicious. We've had 70 years of federal policy trying to subsidize home ownership for the middle class, and now we have massive financial institutions like Blackstone buying these single family homes because millennials can't rent them, poor people can't buy them, and millennials can't buy them. So it's the idea of taking advantage of the housing crisis, and that's a deeply pernicious issue. And so far, none of the bills of any of the senators that we reviewed so far have actually addressed that. So that's something that we're really looking forward to working with campaigns and to seeing candidates really jump on, because it's just evil.
And what about Cory Booker?
Yeah, Cory Booker's plan is a little bit of a hybrid between Senator Harris and Senator Warren. He is doing direct rental assistance just like Harris, but he is trying to address some of the more structural issues about zoning, restrictive zoning that Elizabeth Warren has done. We think given his experience as a mayor, he can speak a lot to housing. But, so far it's been a little bit about rental assistance, a little bit about more of a carrot than a stick for exclusionary zoning. So there's not a lot of teeth to it quite at this point.
Okay. Well, that's three early looks at their policies. Of course, there are 35 candidates. So hopefully we can have you back on. In the near future to break down some more. I'm very interested in seeing Bernie Sanders in particular, what he's going to do on this. So Pete Harrison, Senior Housing Advisor for Data for Progress, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Donald Trump butting heads with some of his current and former economic advisors. We'll see who has the facts on their side after this. Donald Trump is easily one of the most aggressively ignorant people in the history of our country, but don't take my word for it. I'm biased. Let Donald Trump make the case.
Will the MOUs be a long-term deal? How long would your MOUs stay?
I think the MOU is going to be very short-term. No, we expect to go into... I don't like MOUs because they don't mean anything. To me, they don't mean anything. I think you're better off just going into a document.
An MOU is a contract. It's the way trade agreements are generally used. People refer to it like it's a term sheet. It's not a term sheet. It's an actual contract between the two parties.
Yes.
A memorandum of understanding is a binding agreement between two people.
By the way, I disagree. I think that a memorandum of understanding is not a contract to the extent that we want. We're doing a memorandum of understanding that will be put into a final contract, I assume. But to me, the final contract is really the thing, Bob, and I think you mean that too, is really the thing that means something. A memorandum of understanding is exactly that. It's a memorandum of what our understanding is. But to me, the contract is, the real question is, Bob, so we do a memorandum of understanding, which frankly, you could do or not do. I don't care if you do it or not. To me, it doesn't mean very much. But if you do a memorandum, how long will it take to put that into a final binding contract?
What? From now on, we're not using the word memorandum of understanding anymore. We're going to use the term trade agreement, all right?
Okay. Right.
No more. We'll never use the term again. We'll have the same document. It's going to be called a trade agreement. We're never going to use MOU again.
Are they going to put that into another agreement?
What we'll have will be a trade agreement. We have major hurdles. I don't want to put the cart in front of the horse. Assuming you decide on an agreement, it'll be signed by the two people. It'll be a trade agreement between the United States and China.
I like that much better. I like that term much better.
Do you agree with that?
That was an epic effort by Robert Lighthizer, U.S. Trade Representative. But dude, if you want to get Trump to understand what you mean, you have to go over and you have to twist his ear and say, shut up, little boy, and let the adults speak. So that was insane. I mean, maybe this is kind of an aside, but I feel like if you've never really understood what mansplaining was like, that I think is what it's like to hear someone who knows nothing about this thing talking to a person whose life it is and telling them, no, I think what you really mean is this. And so Trump-splaining is very much a thing. Also, hashtag Dunning-Kruger. Go watch the video that we did last week on the Dunning-Kruger effect, because that was the greatest demonstration of it that I've seen in my life. So much so that take a look what happened. So this is about China trade with China. And so when he said, I disagree, so he goes off on what a memorandum of understanding isn't, because he neither understands it nor memorandums it. Then there's a big explanation of what it actually is. And he responds with, I disagree, said a scowling Trump, causing the top Chinese negotiator to laugh at him because he doesn't know what he's talking about and he just had it explained to him. So this is an issue that supposedly, as president, Donald Trump cares a lot about and knows a lot about. In the campaign, he was saying, he talked constantly about trade and how much he knows about it. But he apparently knows less now than he did then, if he knew anything at all at that point. So look, I will attempt to be, and I understand this is breaking my promise because I promise never to be fair to Trump. I will try to be a little bit fair. There are contexts outside of world trade where a memorandum of understanding does mean something less than a binding contract, hypothetically, in some areas. And it's possible that in his life as a private citizen who has been sued many times, he has had to come across these sorts of things. But he's been president for literally years now at this point. He's talking to his chosen trade representative who understands this legal process better than he does, better than I do, better than any of us does. So defer to the person with the knowledge on very specific things like this. But he can't do that. He thinks that he knows better than all of those people, whether the topic is trade with China or ballistic missile technology or whatever. He is always so sure of himself and his brain is so packed full of self-assurance that there's no room for either knowledge or the curiosity necessary to generate new knowledge. So there's that. On a very specific issue, the memorandum of understanding, they literally have to back off of a term in the White House from now on because he has proven that he will never understand what it means. But it goes deeper than that. It goes more fundamental than that. And so now I turn to Janet Yellen. So former chair of the Fed, former official under Donald Trump, asked on Marketplace, the BBC's US radio partner, if she thought the president had a grasp of macroeconomic policy. Janet Yellen replied, no, I do not. Now let's be very specific about what she was asked. Not, could he teach a master's course on macroeconomics? Not does he rise to the level of some of the great economic minds of our time? It's does he have a grasp at all about the fundamentals of macroeconomics? And she says, no, I do not. And she says specifically in terms of his relationship with the Fed, I doubt that he would even be able to say that the Fed's goals are maximum employment and price stability, which is the goals that Congress have assigned to the Fed. And she goes into a detail about why she believes he fundamentally misunderstands what the point of the Federal Reserve is, saying, when I continually hear focus by the president and some of his advisors on remedying bilateral trade deficits with other trade partners, I think almost any economist would tell you that there's no real meaning to bilateral trade deficits, and it's not an appropriate objective of policy. Now, look, there's a lot that I would disagree with Janet Yellen on, but on this fundamental truth, not only do I agree, I have been making this exact point for like 3.5 years now. When he talks about the trade deficit specifically with China, he is not talking as a person with sort of a different perspective on economics. Like, I come at it from a progressive point of view, he comes at it from a conservative point of view. There are people where we would have that disagreement, but that is not the disagreement between myself and Donald Trump. He comes at it from the point of view of a poorly socialized four-year-old. He doesn't know what it means. He just thinks that if the deficit is in their favor, they're winning. Not in some specific macroeconomic context, but just in the sense of, I don't want to be beat. I don't want the US to lose to them. And I refuse to go even one inch further than that and try to understand why there is the trade deficit that there is. And that it is not some sort of thing where there was two negotiators, an American and a Chinese negotiator, and the Chinese negotiator just beat us. It's reflective of consumer habits on the American side and the Chinese side. These are large-scale things that are gradually shifting over the course of decades. They're the collective decisions of tens or hundreds of millions of people that are determining this bilateral trade deficit. It's not a thing where he can just butt his head against them and get his way. And when you have someone who approaches some of the most important trade issues of the day from the perspective of someone who has literally never heard about it, never learned about it, never thought about it, then God only knows what he'll end up doing. And we've already seen the fallout from some of the tariffs that he's put up. He doesn't understand what effect they would have on the industries that he purports to want to defend. When we generate more money by the tariffs, he doesn't even understand who's paying that. He doesn't get fundamentally years into his first term that we're the ones that pay for that. China doesn't do it. I do, you do, the people purchasing the products do. And he really seems to think that he can dramatically shift our buying habits in the course of just a year or two. Maybe long term, something like that might happen. But for now, we are paying to the tunes of literally billions of dollars every year because of his misunderstanding of these fundamental economic truths. Now, the reason that I point out these two cases, with Robert Lighthizer on the one hand and Janet Yellen on the other, is not just to laugh at the president. That's one reason, and it's fun, but that's not the only reason. It's because these are incredibly consequential misunderstandings, where his stupidity and his ignorance now affects not just his life, not just whether Trump vodka or Trump steaks goes under, but whether we go under, whether our country goes under. How will our economy do? To the extent that any president can determine that, he is doing it. And it is an almost universally negative fashion when it comes to world trade. There are experts who get things wrong. Brett and I are actually, we're in the initial stages of a possible book about the history of humans getting the most important things wrong in different fields. So you don't need to defer on experts on everything. And people have agendas. But on basic truths, like what a memorandum of understanding actually is, what the point of the Federal Reserve actually is, Donald Trump, I beg of you, before you destroy us all, listen just a little bit to the people who have spent their lives learning about this stuff. Now, with that said, we're going to take a break, come back, lots more to get to. Very excited to continue a conversation we started a couple of weeks ago with the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, Anand Giridharadas. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. Also, congratulations on the new position, editor-at-large at Time. That's awesome.
Right. Thank you. I'm excited.
Yeah, very excited to see what reporting you do for them throughout the course of the year. And with that, let's
anything big happening in America these days? I mean, I'm wondering if there's going to be any stories out there.
I mean, I hear there's going to be a campaign for the next decade or
right.
so.
Right.
So
with everything on, with the entire nation state on the line. So that should be good.
Exactly. And so, I mean, look, your book very well placed with the current conversation we're having about billionaires and taxation and all of that. And so first I wanted to say that over the past couple of months, it seems like, I don't know if you've noticed this, that there's sort of a sustained campaign in the media to defend billionaires. I know the New York Times had an op-ed with literally that was the title of the defense of bad billionaires. There's continual reporting on their charitable giving and all of that. Howard Schultz has essentially staked his campaign on defending billionaires. What do you think about this narrative?
I would actually put it in a less depressing way than you did for the following reason. I think everything you described is correct, but you have to understand that everything you described, I think, is a back foot defense against what I think has been the real story of the last few months, which is a remarkable opening in the American conversation about billionaires and the common good. I would actually argue that those pieces all have a tone of, hey, careful, don't abolish the billionaire so fast, precisely because of a recognition that we are having a new conversation right now. I'm not sure if we have talked about in my lifetime whether we should have billionaires in general, the way we are talking about that now. I'm not sure we've had, you know, so many presidential candidates rushing out of the gate to support Medicare for all, to support, to think about wealth taxes, raising taxes on the rich. I don't think we've seen poll numbers of the kind that we've seen recently with 51% of Republicans supporting Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax. And so I feel, I mean, I had the luck of having this book come out at what I felt was a kind of very fortuitous moment that I didn't choose. And there were other books in that genre, and there were the midterms, and it feels like it all is of a piece. And we are, for the first time that I really reckon in my lifetime, seeing through a kind of BS narrative that plutocrats have told us, that what is good for them is good for America.
And you mentioned a couple of policies that have been driving some of the conversation recently. So let's talk about that. For a while, the thing was, if you propose some sort of bold solution to healthcare issues, education, climate change, the question is, how are you going to pay for it? Well, now there are answers, and they don't seem to like those answers either. Things like, you know, increasing the top marginal tax rate or a wealth tax. Elizabeth Warren has one formulation of that. They would now have us believe that those are not only political non-starters, but that the people would never actually support that. What is your read on the sort of saleability of these policies?
You know, I think I'm almost like a dance critic of the plutocrats, right? I study their moves. I study how they do this, how they work the discourse, because there's so few of them, right? And so it actually takes some tremendous dance moves to make policies that benefit 1,000 people or 10,000 people or 100,000 people, the law of the land in a country with, you know, 300 plus million people. And one of the key dance moves, it has been on display in all of these. The best example of the thing you just talked about is Michael Bloomberg in some factory. I mean, nothing is more awkward than Michael Bloomberg, you know, with a hard hat in a factory, like trying to seem like a man of the people briefly. And he's in this factory and he says something like, you know, Medicare for all would bring America to its knees. It would bankrupt this country. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's set aside the policy question of whether Medicare for all is better than doing it a different way. I think reasonable people can have an argument about that, regardless of where you or me might stand on that. I think it's ridiculous to suggest that, like, America couldn't survive it. Mm-hmm. Set aside the question of whether it's the right shift. Michael Bloomberg is sitting there suggesting, like, we wouldn't make it. It would just bring us to, we fought the Nazis. We won the Cold War. But Medicare for all, it would kill us. It would just doom the American experiment once and for all. And what is so interesting is we all participate in this in a way. And that's very important. If these people were just, you know, Michael Bloomberg in a velvet robe on the Upper East Side, stroking his chin, burping out his thoughts about how rich people should be taxed less. Mm-hmm. No one would take it seriously because it would just be a need expressing itself as a need, a selfish interest, a parochial interest expressing itself as such. But when these people do philanthropy, or when they go to Davos and talk about Africa, they've never been to Africa maybe, but they talk about it, wear the bracelets. When they start a women's empowerment thing on the side of screwing women in their day job through mortgage products or whatever else, they acquire this moral glow that then allows them to shoot down policies that hurt their interests. And suddenly they're not a rich guy in a robe saying, I don't like high taxes, which is sort of the most obvious thing under the sun. Suddenly they are Michael Bloomberg, moral sage, man whose heart bleeds for the world, who wants to save the planet. And they are spending the moral authority they gain through their legitimate good works on impeding the kind of change that would frankly help the world on a much bigger scale.
There was a case in the media today, actually, that might be an example of this, of people of extreme wealth, as Howard Schultz would put it, wanting the mantle of being an advocate for the working class, but while advancing only their own interests. So I saw that Ivanka Trump, second generation heiress, said in response to, I think it was in particular, AOC raising the minimum pay for her staffers, I don't think most Americans in their heart want to be given something. People want to work for what they get. So I think that this idea of a guaranteed minimum is not something most people want. Do you think that we have found the true advocate for the American working class we've been looking for?
You know, I just think it's such a relief that after 40 years of being stiffed, the American working class finally has an advocate in Ivanka Trump. She may not look or have the gritty fingernails of an advocate of the common man, but there she is. Look, today's statement was so remarkable, and I think with the Trumps, it's always worth reminding us that they're not sui generis. It's not just about them. They embody these things that are true of the age. So. Let's just parse her statement that most people don't want to, you know, and she was talking about specifically this kind of federal job guarantee as part of a Green New Deal, these kind of ideas, which are usually linked to work. And so she is, her father inherited his money from his parents. First of all, a lot of people pointed out that if he just taken the amount that he inherited and put in the stock market, it would be worth way more. So he not only inherited it, but basically squandered it. If he just bought Vanguard ETFs, like, he would have been in better shape. As the New York Times carefully detailed last year, in the process of the father inheriting that money from his parents, committed massive tax avoidance and evasion and all kinds of fraud. So that money was kind of fraudulently passed down in the volume it was. And now she is the second generation heiress, as you said, now benefiting from that. So she is inheriting actually two separate sources of money mingled together. One is her father's and grandparents, which raises the question of whether she's truly a believer in working for what you earn. But the second source of money that is mingled amid that money is actually your and my money and the money of everybody listening to this, which is taxpayer money that was properly owed to the United States, which was not paid to the United States and was instead fraudulently cornered by the Trump family. And so when Ivanka Trump is rich-splaining to people that they should really work for their own money, she is, more than anybody listening to her, living off the private dole of family inheritance and the public dole of stolen public funds, while lecturing people that a federal job guarantee in which they would work to do public works for the government of the United States while being paid for it is somehow immoral. And I just want to say, this is not just Trumpism. This is a move of the billionaire class in general, where it is actually they who live off of public money in so many ways. Their philanthropy is tax subsidized. Their monopolies only exist because the federal government doesn't do antitrust, which is only the case because they lobby so much to prevent that outcome. They're actually the ones who depend on the public good. And then they smear Americans as being welfare queens and welfare kings and as being dependents. When it isn't, like, if you are confident about your chances in the free market, you don't need to lobby.
Yeah.
How many companies at that level don't lobby?
Yeah, that's a good point and a powerful argument. Hopefully people are starting to pay attention to these issues. If you'd like to, in the audience, if you'd like to learn more about this, the book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Anand, as always, we don't have as much time as I would like, but thank you again for joining us on the show. I'll always enjoy it.
Me and the dragon are always ready to come back.
Awesome. Hopefully we'll talk to you soon. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Politico has been on a tear with their editorials against a number of different progressives. We'll be breaking that down after this. Over the past few days, I spent a little bit of time on Politico, and so I think it's long past time for another episode of Garbage People. Now, normally we only put individuals in the can on Garbage People, but I've been reading some of the op-eds on Politico, and I think that the entire organization needs a bit of a timeout in the trash bin. First, their editorial a couple of days ago on Namiki Konst. So she is a candidate for a public advocate in New York City. The election is actually today. If you're there, you can go and vote for her. She's a committed advocate and warrior on progressive issues. She has the track record of working not only for Bernie Sanders and Our Revolution, and the Unity and Reform Commission, all of that. Was Politico interested in that? No. They could have sat down if they wanted to learn about her and then teach their viewers about her in an article titled, Who is Namiki Konst? They could have done that, but they chose not to. This is a poorly written article with a ton of underhanded smears, and it's intended to create this sort of fear or suspicion about who she is, while also not telling you what she would do in the position. An entire article on a candidate for public advocate, the sort of election that normally Politico would not even mention, that goes page after page after page without giving you the slightest idea of who she actually is. You can find out, thankfully, online and from watching a number of different videos we've done with Nomi. So for that reason, Politico, for this article, ends up in the garbage. But that's not it. They continued on. So Bernie Sanders, did you know that this guy, this candidate, who cares about climate change and wants to stop it, wants to lower global carbon emissions, flew on a plane once? Well, they talked with some former Hillary Clinton 2016 staffers who were incensed by Bernie Sanders being such a hypocrite and flying on a plane while also saying that we should try to do something about climate change. And if you want to get an idea of the sort of level of journalism in this, take a look at one of the quotes that Politico uses. This is from Zach Petkanis, who is director of rapid response of the Clinton campaign, who said, I'm not shocked that while thousands of volunteers braved the heat and cold to knock on doors until their fingers bled in a desperate effort to stop Donald Trump, His Royal Majesty King Bernie Sanders would only deign to leave his plush D.C. office or his brand new second home on the lake if he was flown around on a cushy private jet like a billionaire master of the universe. At some point, like two or three sentences in, I think you should understand, Politico, that what you have there is a bit of a biased source. But Politico doesn't mind that. That's why they're doing the article in the first place. This is a hit piece on Bernie Sanders that is as chock full of hypocrisy as any piece of faux journalism I've had the misfortune of reading in my life. First of all, this guy, Zach, he's pissed that Bernie has that second home. Is he complaining about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's great wealth? They're far wealthier than Bernie Sanders. That doesn't bother him in the case of Hillary Clinton. But with Bernie Sanders, it certainly does. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy there on Zach's part. But when it comes to the climate change article or argument, the idea that if you have ever flown on a plane or driven a car that uses an internal combustion engine, you don't get to complain about climate change or do something about the environment is so ridiculous. It's such a BS argument that you don't even see all of the right wing using that. It's usually reserved for people like Tucker Carlson. We have a video. We unfortunately don't have time to show it, but he was pushing that literally this week. But thanks to the power of Politico and pissed off Hillary Clinton staffers from 2016, they have sunk to the depths of Tucker Carlson in their attempts to take down Bernie Sanders. And why? Well, they say the reason is that he was partially contributed to Clinton's defeat in November of 2016, even though Politico has to acknowledge that he did 39 different rallies in 13 states in the 3 months leading up to Election Day, completely dissecting that narrative entirely. But they still ran with it. And they ran with it because their purpose is to destroy a progressive, especially as he is attempting to become president in 2020. And so for that reason as well, Politico, for your op-eds recently, you end up in the garbage as the first organization ever enshrined in Garbage People. To everyone who's been watching the show, thank you so much for joining us. There was so much more that I wish we could have gotten to, but there's unfortunately just 1 hour. Maybe we'll expand the show someday. But for now, that's what we have for you. By the way, to everyone who has taken the time to write a review and to rate us on iTunes or who subscribed to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheDamageReport, we appreciate that so, so much. Thank you for continuing to watch. We'll see you tomorrow morning with a lot more news for you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.